Thanks, Ivan. So first of all, thank you very much to the organizers for the invitation. It's extremely nice to be in California in February. So my talk today will be on beta ensembles, which are sort of a one parameter family of point processes generalizing the eigenvalues of Hermitian random matrices. And what I will be interested in will be the statistics of the edge eigenvalues, or the largest eigenvalues, or the rightmost points in this point process. So this is the brief outline of the talk. So first, I will give a very quick introduction to random matrices, just to separate everything up. And I will tell you about the essentially the two types of approaches we have to edge limits. So one is for the case when the parameter beta is equal to 2, so when we're really dealing with eigenvalues of Hermitian random matrices. And as we know, in that case, we have explicit formulas to our disposal, so there is more we can do there. And I will tell you a little bit about the history for that case. And then, you know, in the last part of the introduction, I will explain what people could do so far for the case of general beta, so when beta is not equal to 2. And then in the main part of the talk, I will present a new approach to studying the edge for general beta. And all of this is joint work with Vadim Gorin that we recently finished. Okay, so you know, I don't like people to be bored in my talk, so recently I've been doing exactly the same trick I do in my lectures with students. So, you know, for the experts, here is a problem that you can think about while I do the introduction. So here is the problem, and it will come up in the talk in a very prominent place. So it goes as follows. So we start with a Brownian excursion on the time interval 0, 1. So this is just a Brownian bridge connecting 0 to 0 in time 1 and conditioned to be positive. And we look at its local times, LA. So we look at the amount of time the bridge spends on some level A. Right, so to be more precise, you put a little band around this level, you measure the time spent in this band, and then you let the size of the band go to zero, and the limit is defined as this local time. And so now, suppose you look at the following quantities. So you take the integral of the excursion, which is precisely the area under the excursion, and you compare it to 1/2 times the integral of the square of the local time as you integrate over all possible levels. And so the claim is that this difference is a Gaussian random variable with mean 0 and variance of 1 over 12. Okay, so this is something to think about for the experts, and we will come back to this a little bit later. Okay, so coming back to the main story, so to set up the beta ensembles, let me start with the integrable case of beta equal to 2. And you know, it's essentially in every talk on random matrices, the starting point is somehow the Gaussian unitary ensemble. So that's the simplest model of a Hermitian random matrix that we have. So what we do here, we choose the diagonal entries as IID standard normals, real standard normals. We choose the entries above the diagonal as IID standard complex normals. And then we just make the matrix Hermitian by putting the conjugates of these upper triangular entries below the diagonal. Okay, and so of course in random matrices we're interested in spectral properties of the matrix, and so my talk today will be only about eigenvalues, so there will be no eigenvectors floating around. And so, you know, just to set up notation, so the eigenvalues I will write as lambda 1 up to lambda n, and I will always order them in decreasing order. And what I will be interested in will be the largest eigenvalues. So suppose we fix some number k, we look at the k largest eigenvalues, and we let n go to infinity. And we want to know how the vector of these k largest eigenvalues behaves. Right, so if you're only interested in eigenvalues, what you quickly realize is that for beta equal to 2, you can actually compute the joint eigenvalue density, right, as we, most of us know. So if you look at the point process of the eigenvalues on the real line, turns out the joint density is of this rather simple form. So this product here would just say that you throw in eigenvalues IID at random as standard normals. And then, of course, you have some interaction between them, which is encoded by the van der Monde determinant squared. Right? So you have these particles confined by quadratic potential, and they interact by repelling each other, which is encoded by this term here. And so if you take this point of view, then somehow there is no particularly good reason to take the power of the van der Monde to be 2, right? You can look at every interaction strength you want, and this naturally leads to the definition of the beta ensemble, where we take the van der Monde to some other positive power beta, right? And so the higher the beta, the stronger is the repulsion between the particles. Okay, so in the case that beta is equal to 2, we know from the work of Tracy and Widom how the Lachesis eigenvalues behave. So we know we have to first scale down the Lachesis eigenvalues by root n. This will make them order 1. And if you do that, this fraction here will be very close to 2. So we will subtract 2 to get something close to 0. And then we scale up to see something non-trivial in the limit. The scaling turns out to be n to the 2/3, so this KPZ type scaling. And once you look at these rescaled eigenvalues, the point process will converge to some non-trivial limit. The limit turns out to be a determinantal point process, a point process in which the correlation functions can be expressed as determinants. And in this case, you have an explicit kernel, which you can write in terms of the area function. And the area function, in turn, is a special solution of this ordinary differential equation. So in principle, when beta is equal to 2, we have a full understanding of the limit. But you can still ask yourself, you know, what can we actually compute about this limiting process? So are there some observables for which we can get, you know, particularly tractable and simple formulas? And one type of observables of this kind was found by Okuinkov. And they go as follows. So instead of looking at the points in your point process, what he looked at were these Laplace transforms, right? So you fix some positive parameter t greater than 0. You look at the Laplace transform of the point mass measure corresponding to a point process. And that's the type of object that you study. So more precisely, what Okuinkov looked at were moments of these types of observables. So you can take one such observable, raise it to some integer power, and try to compute its expectation. And then, you know, if you succeed with that, you could try to take several ones, so different Laplace parameters, t1 and t2, and look at mixed moments. And so if you look at these original moments, turns out that you can obtain relatively simple formulas for them, in particular for the small moments. And so the simplest formula that you can find in Okuinkov's paper is the following. So you take just the first moment of the Laplace transform, and then you get a completely explicit result. So you get, you know, this very explicit and simple function of t. You get a similarly explicit result for the second moment, and then it gets somewhat more complicated, but the formulas are still kind of very tractable. They're still sort of one-line formulas that you can write out. Now, the questions that you can raise at this point is, so first of all, you can ask yourself what part of this theory extends to more general values of beta, right? And in particular, if you look at the beta ensemble with some generic positive beta, you can ask yourself, can you find some version of Okuinkov's formulas, or maybe, you know, some analog of the area function or the area kernel in that framework, right? And also, you know, you might hope that in this more general framework, you can understand why it is the right thing to do to look at Laplace transforms of the point process. So what is the reason that you get particularly simple formulas for these exact observables and not for other ones? And also, you know, you can then come back to beta equal to 2 and ask yourself, why is beta equal to 2 in some sense special? So in which sense, you know, some formulas may be simplified when beta is equal to 2, and what are the special features that lead to the simplification? So if you look at more general values of beta, then somehow the tools are much more restricted, and essentially the main, or pretty much the most powerful tool that we have are the so-called three diagonal matrix models of Dimitri and Edelman. So we know that if beta is not equal to 1, 2, or 4, there is no kind of symmetric matrix model which will lead to the eigenvalue distribution of this beta ensemble type. But you can still ask yourself, okay, maybe there is a matrix model with independent entries, maybe not symmetric, but you know, there still you have independent entries which will lead to the right eigenvalue distribution. And this model was discovered by Dimitri and Edelman in 2002. So the answer is yes. And what you have to do is the following. So you set up a three diagonal matrix model. So all the entries except for the main diagonal and the two neighboring diagonals are zero. And what you do, you put IID normal entries on the diagonal, means zero, and okay, the variance is just a normalization that will be convenient for us. And then on the two diagonals next to the main one, you put chi-distributed entries with a parameter beta, being the same beta as in the beta ensemble. And then, okay, again, you normalize to make computations a bit easier, right? And so the result of Dimitri and Edelman is that if you look at the joint distribution of eigenvalues of a matrix of this type, you will get exactly the beta ensemble. All right, so why does it help? Well, the point is that these matrices are actually much nicer to work with even when beta is equal to 2. And the reason is that the entries are of different size. Okay? Sorry? So chi squared would be, for integer beta, chi squared, or say chi, would be the norm of a standard normal distribution in dimension beta. Okay? So chi squared has a gamma distribution, to be precise, and chi is the square root of a gamma distributed random variable. Okay? Yes? Yes, yes, right. And that's actually important. Yes, so I forgot to mention that. So it's very important, in fact. So on the off diagonals, you're not putting IID entries, but instead, so you choose the parameter to be beta, 2 beta, 3 beta, up to n minus 1 beta. And that actually helps a lot because it turns out, so it leads to the fact that the entries you get below with the large parameters of order n, they will be much, much larger than the entries that you have closer to the top. So you have already not so many entries which are non-zero in this matrix, but in addition, the entries which will somehow contribute, there are even fewer of those because they're all sitting down there where the parameters of the chi are of order n. Okay, so in particular, what you can hope to do is that you can rescale the whole matrix by root n. Okay, that's the scaling that we know we should apply to see the fluctuations of the largest eigenvalues. And with the original matrix, somehow all entries were of order 1. So if you divide all of them by root n, it's kind of hard to see what will go on in the limit. Whereas with this matrix, you have some entries which are now on the right order, on the order of root n. So if you divide by root n, you might hope that your whole matrix will actually converge to an operator which will correspond to the fluctuations of the entries in this matrix. And this sort of heuristic turns out to be correct. So it was first explained in detail in this paper by Edelman and Sutton in 2007. And so essentially what they do is the following. So they look at these large chi-distributed entries. So think of M as being on order N. So you're close to the top of the matrix, to the bottom of the matrix in my picture. right? And so such a chi-distributed random variable would be very close to square root of m with some order one fluctuation. And so what Edelman and Sutton suggest is that you should take the diagonal entries of your matrix, take these fluctuations of the large of diagonal entries, and combine them into sums of id random variables. If you look at these sums, by the central limit theorem, they will converge to Brownian motions. The two Brownian motions will be independent because the entries on the diagonal and on the off-diagonal are independent. And then you can hope that once you rescale the matrix correctly, you will find a limiting infinite dimensional operator with some deterministic part, which will correspond essentially to the means of the off-diagonal entries, and some stochastic perturbation on top of that, which will correspond exactly to these two Brownian motions coming from the sums of these fluctuations and of the diagonal entries. And so Edelman and Sutton have derived non-rigorously what the limiting operator should look like, and that's the operator that we now call the stochastic area operator. So it's this operator looks as follows. So we have a deterministic part, which is just a deterministic area operator with an area function being an eigenfunction of this guy. And we have a stochastic part to this operator, which is just white noise. And you should think about this white noise as a derivative of the Brownian motion coming from the entries, right? So if you in the pre-limit model, you have this IID environment given by the diagonal entries and the fluctuations of the off-diagonal entries. And so the limit of this environment, you should think of as being this white noise arising in the stochastic area operator. So this intuition outlined by Edelman and Sutton was made precise by Ramirez, Wright, and Virag, who explained in their paper that, So they explained in their paper how you should actually make sense of this operator as an operator on L2 of zero infinity. And in addition, they could show that the eigenvalues of this operator are really the limits of the rescaled H eigenvalues of the beta ensemble. Okay, so what is the result? So you rescale the largest eigenvalues, so which are now just the rightmost points in the beta ensemble, according to the same scaling as before, as in the Tracy-Widom result. And they could show that the resulting rescaled point process will converge, with the limit being exactly the ordered eigenvalues of the stochastic operator, which you view as an operator on L2 of zero infinity with Dirichlet boundary condition. Right, and so again, you know, in principle, you have a full understanding of the limit, right? So in principle, you have a characterization of how the limit of the rescaled largest eigenvalues looks like, but you can again ask yourself, okay, what can you actually do with this limit, right? So what kind of quantities can you compute? And in addition, you can try to find the quantities we have seen for beta equal to 2 in this description, right? So we can try to look for the area function, we can try to look for Kunkov's formulas and try to see where they arise in this operator. And somehow from this description, if you look at the operator, it's much less clear how, so why beta equal to 2 should be special. So if you go back to the definition of this white noise, you see that, you know, this beta just shows up as a constant in front of the Brownian motion or the white noise. So it's somehow not clear why a particular multiple of this white noise should give you a nicer structure than other multiples. Okay, so that was sort of the starting point of our work. And so, you know, one of the goals was to find a framework in which you can combine these two pictures. So the integrable picture with Kunkov's formulas and the area functions and the stochastic operator picture of Ryder, Ramirez, and Virag. And so here is kind of the key player in our description. So what is written here is a stochastic random integral kernel, which is defined as follows. So we have two random objects here. So one is a Brownian bridge that I will call BXY. So that's a Brownian bridge connecting X to Y in time capital T. And the second random object is a standard Brownian motion that I call W beta. And the beta is just kind of hidden in the standard deviation of this Brownian motion. So this is a Brownian motion. Sorry, it's a standard Brownian motion times a constant, which depends on beta, to be completely precise. And so this random kernel is defined as the expectation with respect to the Brownian bridge of this functional depending on both the Brownian bridge and the Brownian motion. And so the only object I have still to explain is this LA of BXY, which is the local time of the Brownian bridge on level A. So we measure how much time the Brownian bridge spends on any given level. We integrate this as a stochastic integral with respect to an independent Brownian motion. And you know, we have these additional simpler terms in our functional. And afterwards, we take the expectation of all the possible paths that the Brownian bridge could have taken from X to Y. OK, so this is a random integral kernel. And so let me explain to you how this kernel is connected to everything that we have seen before. OK, so first of all, let me connect it to the stochastic area operator. Right, so what we show is that if you define integral operators as just the operators with integral kernel given by the formula in the previous slide and rescaled by this constant factor, then you can show that these operators will actually form a semigroup with probability 1. So the kernels are random, but you can define all of them simultaneously on the same probability space, and you can make sense of them forming a semigroup. And turns out that this statement will hold with probability 1. And in addition, each one of them will be just an exponential of the stochastic area operator defined in a suitable spectral sense. Right? So you know, from this point of view, you should think of the stochastic area operator as simply being the generator of the semigroup given by the integral operators that I wrote down before. And that's why we call the semigroup the stochastic area semigroup. So that's the second part of the title of the talk. Okay, so in particular, what does it tell us? Well, if you look at the Laplace transform of the eigenvalues of the stochastic area operator, so this is the type of observable that Okonkov looked at. On the one hand, this Laplace transform is a trace of the exponential of the stochastic area operator with the same parameter t. On the other hand, we know this exponential is now given by the integral operator that I wrote down before. And so the trace, provided the kernel is nice, should be given by the integral of the kernel over the diagonal. Right? And we can actually justify that you know, the operator is nice enough that you have the trace formula and you can express the trace in this simpler form. Okay, so that's, you know, a first connection to something we have seen before. So in addition, we can connect the semigroup also directly to three diagonal models. And the connection goes as follows. So first, we will put three diagonal models and our operators on the same space. And we will do it by acting with our three diagonal matrices on L2 functions. Okay, and this is done sort of in the usual way. So if you have an L2 function, we will look at the averages of this function over small intervals of lengths n to the minus 1/3, rescaled appropriately. And so every L2 function we will turn into a vector of these averages where we shift the little intervals, you know, we start from 0 to n to the minus 1/3. The second average will be from n to the minus 1/3 to 2 times n to the minus 1/3, and so on. And we'll look at n of these averages. So we get all the way to n to the 2/3. And so we combine these averages into an n-dimensional vector. And now we can act on this n-dimensional vector by our n by n three-diagonal matrix. And for example, we can look at the corresponding quadratic form. Right? So for two L2 functions, I can think of the three diagonal matrix as defining a quadratic form on L2, which just acts by taking the transpose of the vector corresponding to F times my matrix times the vector corresponding to G. Okay, and so if you do that, you can relate the original matrix model directly to our semigroup as follows. So you take the three diagonal matrix, you rescale by root n, as discussed before, and you raise it to a high power. So it turns out that the right type of powers to look at is of order n to the 2/3, and you put in a parameter t, which will precisely correspond to the t in the semigroup. And then, sort of for convenience, we combine one even power with one odd power, but in principle, you can just focus on this first term here. And so what we show is that if you look at this high power of the three diagonal matrix appropriately normalized, then the corresponding quadratic form will converge to the quadratic form given by the limiting integral operator. So this is just, you know, the usual L2 inner product of a function f with our operator acting on the function g. And the convergence is in the following sense. So, you know, first of all, if you look at these quantities, they will converge in finite dimensional distributions and in the sense of moments. And in addition, you have convergence of traces, which we're particularly interested in because they will lead us to observables of the limiting process. So we can show that the trace of the high power of this random matrix will converge to the trace of this limiting integral operator, which in turn we already know is the integral of the kernel over the diagonal. Right, so in particular, we can deduce from this that if we look at the Laplace transform of the eigenvalues of the original three diagonal model, so this is the Laplace transform of the bit ensemble, it's not hard to see that the limit of that is the same as the limit of the trace of the high power of the matrix. And from the theorem, we know the limit of this trace is the trace of the limiting operator. So in particular, we have found a new description for the limit of the Laplace transforms of beta ensembles, now for all values of betas, right? And this convergence is, again, in distribution and in the sense of moments as before. Okay, so, you know, at this point, you can ask yourself, in all of this, how do you see the special role of beta equal to 2, right? So in all of these operators, why does something special happens when you choose the coefficient of the white noise correctly? And so here is a computation which you know, should give you a first idea why beta equal to 2 is special. Okay, so the starting point as before, I just copied the formula here, is this formula that the trace of the limiting operator, which is this integral of the kernel, is the same as the Laplace transform of the process of eigenvalues. Okay, so suppose you start with this and you want to end up with, say, Okunkov's formula for the first moment of such a Laplace transform. Okay, so what do you have to do? You have to take the expectation on both sides. So if you take the expectation on the right-hand side, you're really taking the expectation with respect to this Brownian motion. Right, you have these two random objects, the bridge and the Brownian motion, but you have already taken the expectation over the bridge. So to take the overall expectation of this term, you have to now take the expectation with respect to Brownian motion. And so let's try to compute that. Okay, so first, I will just use Fubini. So originally, I would have an expectation here outside, but I will move it all the way inside this expectation here. Okay, so I'm now taking the expectation with respect to W of this whole object. But W and B are just independent, so I can completely ignore this part, right? It has nothing to do with the expectation I want to take. So really, I'm just taking the expectation of the exponential of the stochastic integral here. And I have an integrand which is independent of the Brownian motion. So with respect to W, in other words, conditional on the path of B, what is written here is just a normal random variable. And so for a normal random variable, I can compute the Laplace transform, and I get, you know, this formula here, right? So instead of the stochastic integral, if I take the expectation with respect to W, I get this formula. Okay, so to proceed, I will need to use a somewhat fancier trick, which is a so-called Fermat transform. Okay, so this is something that people have developed to study past transformations of Brownian motions, Brownian bridges, and related objects. Okay, so what is a Fermat transform? So you start with a continuous path, and you know it will be particularly simple if you start with a path which starts and ends at zero. Okay, so think of a path of a Brownian bridge connecting zero to zero. And what the Fermat transform is doing, you first find the global minimum of the path. So for this path here, this would be the global minimum. And then you split the path into two pieces. So you cut it at the global minimum, and you attach the first part to the second part. Okay, so you cut the path, you have now two pieces of the path, and you append the first piece to the second one to get a new continuous path. Okay, so you got, you know, some new path. And so Fermat's theorem is saying that if you start with a path of a Brownian bridge, the new path that you will get will have the law of a Brownian excursion. Okay, and that's, you know, the trick that we will use to study our function. So, you know, this is just, again, our functional. So we will do the following. So first of all, you can make a trivial observation that it's not important that the bridge is going from x to x. You can really take a bridge going from 0 to 0 and just lift it by x. That's obvious. So then, you know, in this first term here, you will just have x plus b0, 0. Secondly, you can notice that we're integrating here over all levels that our bridge can visit because we have this indicator that the bridge is always positive, right? And so since we're integrating over all levels, it doesn't really matter if we integrate the squared local time for the original bridge or the squared local time for this new shifted bridge connecting 0 to 0. Okay, so in other words, the dependence on x here is very simple. It just comes in additively. There is no dependence on x here. We can rewrite this functional in terms of the 0 to 0 bridge. And in this indicator, well, what does this indicator mean? Well, it means our bridge has to be always above 0. Or in other words, the minimum of the bridge has, so the minimum of bxx has to be greater than 0, which means that x plus the minimum of the shifted bridge has to be greater than 0, which means the minimum of b00 is greater than minus x. So the x only shows up in two places. It shows up here just additively, right? You just have x plus b00, and it shows up in this indicator. So what you can do, you can just integrate an x, right? You're just integrating an exponential function from minus this minimum here up to infinity. So if you do that, instead of having x plus b00 in here, you will get b00 minus the minimum. And that's great because if you look at this picture, right, you want the integral of the bridge relative to the minimum, right? So think of drawing a line on the level of the minimum, and we want to compute the area under the bridge and above this line. But that's exactly the area under the Brownian excursion by Fermat's transform, right? So by Fermat's transform, you can just shift the line to be a line on level zero. And if you just switch the two parts of the path, the area will remain unchanged. So you can go from the area under the Brownian bridge that you would have here to the area under the Brownian excursion. And then you get a much simpler formula, which looks as follows. So remember, we're computing the expectation of the trace of our integral operator. And so now we can write it in terms of a Brownian excursion as follows. So we get the area under the Brownian excursion, and I have normalized it to be on the time interval 0, 1, and the price I pay is that I get a coefficient in terms of t by Brownian scaling. And then instead of integrating the local times of my bridge, I'm now integrating the local times of my excursion, and this uses the fact that I have just rearranged the path, so I haven't really changed the local times. I still spend exactly the same amount of time on every level, just that the levels have shifted. But since I'm integrating over all levels, I can move to the local times of the excursion. Okay, so now at this point, you can compare the formula we get with the formula for Kunkov. So Kunkov had exactly the same prefactor, so this stuff will cancel out. And the formula you will get will be this formula here. So you have this expectation on the right-hand side, and you know, without the prefactor, his function was e to the t cubed over 96. But now if you look carefully at this, so you have t to the 3 halves here and here, so you can take out minus t to the 3 half over 2, and this factor will multiply the random variable that I had in my problem for experts, right? And so what is written on the left-hand side is the Laplace transform of this random variable at the point minus t to the 3 half over 2, and that's the formula for the Laplace transform, and we know there is exactly one random variable which has this kind of Laplace transform, and that's a Gaussian random variable with mean 0 and variance 1 over 12, variance 12. Okay, so this is, you know, a solution to the problem that I stated in the beginning, but, you know, very unfortunately, we don't have a direct proof of this fact. Okay, so we don't know of a proof which would only use, you know, something about Brownian excursions and would not go through random matrices and the combinatorics that Okunkov is doing in his paper, right? So what is somehow the point? The point is you have these two rather complicated random variables, the area under the Brownian excursion and the second random variable, which is often called the self-intersection local time of the excursion. They're both kind of complicated, but when beta is equal to 2, you take the difference of them exactly with the right multiples, and somehow this difference drastically simplifies, and you get simply a Gaussian random variable. Okay, so as I said, we don't have a direct proof of this fact, but there are some partial results available in the literature in this direction. So first of all, you know, not very surprisingly, there is a paper by Mark Yor related to these functionals of Brownian excursion. And so it's with two co-authors, Chorgo and Shi. And what they show is that at least these two random variables that show up, the area under the Brownian excursion and the intersection local time, they have the same distribution. Okay, so at the very least, we can justify that the difference of the two has mean zero, right? Because they have the same distribution. Now, this fact is based on a very deep result due to Jolin, which goes as follows, and it was also sort of a guiding principle in the proofs of our results, so it's not only a nice asset at this point. So this result explains so why this quantity here, so areas of functionals of the Brownian excursion are related to functionals of its local time. And it goes as follows. So you start with the Brownian excursion E. You look at its local times, okay, but you will look at the local times, the L's, on a certain clock. So you will time change, okay, so you will go from the lowest level the excursion visits, which is zero, to the highest level the excursion visits, which is the maximum of your excursion. And you will look at the local times on these different levels, but you go through them in an appropriate speed, on an appropriate clock, and the clock is just given by the integral of the local times themselves, which you then invert. Okay, so what is the result? You look at these local times on this sort of fancy clock given by the inverse of the integral of the local times, and Jolin's theorem is saying that this new process is again a Brownian excursion. And the point of all this is that if you look at the self-intersection local time, this is nothing else but just the area under this new excursion. And this is why the two random variables have the same distribution, because you can actually see both of them as areas under the Brownian excursion. Okay, so this is how much we know in the direction of this open problem, but really what you have to understand is somehow the joint, the distribution of these two excursions, or of these two random variables, and that's something that we don't understand at this point. Okay, so let me show you another nice corollary of our result, and then I will say a little bit about the proofs, but without making it too technical. So, you know, another special case that you can look at is the case beta equal to infinity. You know, the case when you let beta go to infinity. Right, so remember we had the constant in front of the white noise in the stochastic area operator, which was 2 over root beta. So if you let beta go to infinity, this constant will go to 0, and your stochastic area operator in the limit will just become the deterministic area operator. So if you pass to the limit in our formula from before, you get the following result. So, you know, there is no expectation here because these are now eigenvalues of this deterministic operator. So we'll look at the trace of e to the t, of e to the minus t, to be precise, times this guy. And so this trace we can now write in terms of the area under the Brownian excursion. And again, the formula has simplified because we have beta in the denominator. So if I let beta go to infinity, this whole part will disappear, and I will just see the area under the Brownian excursion. So you get this relative, you know, very nice formula, right? So you can express the Laplace transform of the spectrum of this operator in terms of a Brownian excursion area. And this fact turns out to be actually known. So there is a rather long, I think, 80-page survey paper by Svante Jansson about the Brownian excursion area, so just about this one random variable, where he explains, you know, how it relates to all sorts of combinatorial problems. And in particular, you know, one of the formulas he has in this in his paper can be written in this form. So if you look at the Laplace transform of this object, so he wouldn't care a priori about the separator operator at all, but, you know, if you care about this random variable, you might want to compute its Laplace transform. So that's, you know, something he does in his paper, and he gets this formula in terms of the eigenvalues of the area operator, and there is a related formula in terms of the zeros of the area function. And he attributes this formula to Darling and Lushore in his paper. Okay, so kind of coming back to the main story, let me maybe say a little bit, a few words about the proofs, and yeah, with the 3 minutes in mind. And in particular, I will show you how, you know, a discrete version of Jolin's result helps you to analyze the quantities we want to analyze. Okay, so kind of the key to our result is to look at the high powers of our three diagonal matrix MN and to study the traces of these high powers. So this is really the computation that leads you to the integral operator that I wrote down. So if you take a high power of this three diagonal matrix, right, and you look at the entries will be given, you know, by sums of products of the entries of the original matrix. And you have a constraint on the entries that you are picking up because you started with a three diagonal matrix. So in each step, so you're going here from I to j because you're computing the ij entry of a power of this guy. And in every step, you can only move by one. So at most by one. So you can move by plus one, by minus one, or by zero, which means that you're multiplying here with an off-diagonal entry above the diagonal, below the diagonal, or you're multiplying with a diagonal entry. So what we're really doing here is we're summing of a path of random walks that can go either up by one or down by one or stay in the same location. And for each path of a random walk, we take the corresponding product of the matrix entries. Now, because we're interested in the power n to the 2/3, we will take the starting point. We should take the starting and end points to be of distance n to the 1/3 apart, right? Because a random walk of length n to the 2/3 will reach levels n to the 1/3 away from the starting point. So these are kind of the types of entries that we should look at. And so, so we will be looking at these sums for I and j of this form. Okay, and so you can realize, maybe I should say it here, so you can realize, if you go back to the three-diagonal matrix model, that we had these off-diagonal entries, which were large, right, because we're looking close to the bottom right corner of the matrix, where the off-diagonal entries will be of order root n, whereas all the diagonal entries were of order 1. So if you look at these products, you cannot afford to pick up too many diagonal entries, and you can actually, you know, figure out that only products where you take finitely many diagonal entries will contribute. And so essentially you can focus on the off-diagonal entries in this product. And so then the problem becomes the following. So you have the random walk bridge, which connects I to J, corresponding to the entry you want to analyze. This bridge makes n to the 2/3 steps. So you will visit an order of n to the 1/3 sites, right? So if you have a bridge of length n to the 2/3, just by Brownian scaling or random walk scaling, that's the number of sites you will visit, right? And we know, roughly speaking, we will spend an order of n to the 1/3 time at every one of the sites that we will visit, right? So once you notice this heuristics, you realize that what you should really study are somehow the local times of this random walk bridge, right? Because the local times will tell you how often you will pick up the same off diagonal entry in such a product. And so you will get, you know, some entry to the power being the local time of the bridge at the particular location, and you will have a product of these guys. And so this is why somehow to understand the typical behavior, you will have to deal with the local times of a typical random walk bridge path connecting I to J. And so so this you can do based on tools developed by Chorgo, Rivesh, Borodin, Hoshnevisan, and Bass, who explain how you can relate local times of random walks or random walk bridges in a very strong form to local times of the limiting Brownian bridges. And so once you have a coupling of the two where the local times are sufficiently close, you can move from the discrete functional, which involves a random walk, to the limiting functional, which involves a limiting Brownian bridge. And so that's how you analyze kind of the typical behavior of this large moment. In addition, you need some kind of large deviation estimate, which tells you that, you know, atypical path of the random walk bridges will not contribute too much. And so here we use a discrete version of Chollat's theorem, which is really the last thing I will say. So, you know, we want to know somehow to control this quantity here, want to control this integral of the squared local time for a random walk bridge. And so the way to do it is to look at the so-called quantile transform. So, you know, in Chollat's theorem, we were looking at the local times of the Brownian bridge on the different levels. We were going through them at the right rate, so with the right clock, and we were seeing a Brownian excursion. And there is a discrete analog of this, which is the following. So you look at the discrete random walk bridge. You look at the amounts of time you spent on the different levels, starting from the smallest one and ending with the largest one. And if you go through these numbers at the right rate, you will see essentially a discrete version of the limiting Brownian excursion. And this is something we use a lot to understand the large deviation behavior of these sums. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you for that.
Questions.
So you mentioned also this, you know, higher order Okunkov identities. I mean, is there anything?
Right. So, for example,
you can sort
if you look,
illuminate on those.
Yeah. So, So essentially, from each of them, you get an identity for a functional of Brownian excursions, And the connection is, so basically, when you go from the expectation to the second moment, you will now have two Brownian excursions. And so we'll look at the sum of areas of two Brownian excursions minus something like the intersection local time, again, for the pair of them. And so his formula will tell you what the Laplace transform of this object is. So it will tell you the distribution. But you know, since we don't have a direct proof, even on the level of expectations, we didn't go there. But you know, the first thing to figure out is where this Gaussian random variable comes from when you compute the expectation. And then you know, maybe you will have a technology to go to higher moments as well.
I have a question. For spiked models, there's also a nice analog of stochastic area operator where you have kind of different types of initial,
right.
Rather than Dirichlet initial data. Do you guys have a similar story that can be done?
So we haven't thought about it yet, but yes, so the suspicion is that there is a similar story for that as well, but we haven't investigated it yet.
Other questions?
So if I understand correctly, so you do not independently reproduce Borodin Okunkov's formula, right?
No. Yes. So right. So to do that, you need to exactly you know solve this problem that I stated. Then
yeah,
you would
sure.
be able to produce his formula. Yes.
And then my second question: is there for another value of beta where you would have a very explicit Okunkov type formula, for instance, beta as a half?
That's a good question, but we don't know. So I think really, you know, once if you can understand the beta equal to 2 case independently, then there is hope to do more, right? So optimally, if you can understand the joint distribution of these two excursions that come up in this formula, then, you know, you would be able to write down formulas of his type for all values of beta, in fact. But you know we're not there yet, so we have to understand this functional a bit better.
But we know that certain betas are very special, for instance 2, but
right.
half is also very special and 1 of course 2. So maybe there.
Yes, so it's possible. Right, exactly. So it's possible that this functional will have you know particularly nice, well-known distributions for these values, but we don't know it yet.
Other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Misha again and all the speakers for the morning.